Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Night vision. Can you see me in the dark, curled up and hiding places? Give you permission. Come and find me under all my different
Hello and welcome to another episode of I'm Not Being Funny, but the podcast where we ask the questions we pretend we knew the answers to, or the ones we didn't think to ask. Now, parents are always a prickly, hairy, protruding kind of subject. I don't know about you, but going through university, I feel like sharing your sex life with somebody was an intimate act, but talking about your relationship with your parents to somebody meant you were real friends. Knowing from your own experience it's hard to talk about your relationship with your parents, it can often be the case that when you stumble upon somebody who has a particularly unusual or complex parent, talking about it seems awkward. In fact, the best thing to do is smile and say, "Oh, that sounds hard for you." I have to admit, that has sometimes been my approach to the problem of parents. And then I met my friend Charlie. When I started this podcast, I knew she was one of the people that I wanted you to meet too. Charlie, even more than just leaking information or little snippets about her relationship with her mum, is one of the first people I met who actively wanted to share her very heartbreaking and, in a lot of cases, quite hilarious relationship with her mum. We talk about how class structures play into talking about mental health. We talk about the shame of luxury and benefits, and how to ask or support somebody who is supporting somebody with a mental illness. I hope you enjoy it and love Charlie as much as I do.
Thanks for being here, Charlie.
Oh, pleasure. Pleasure to pleasure. Be here with such a pleasure. Wonderful woman. This is all about people who have a close relative, the children of mental health survivors.
I feel like, and correct me if I'm wrong, I feel like a lot of the coverage of mental health and stuff like that is always about the person who is suffering, which is obviously really, really important.
Yep.
And we'll also, like, it's really good for me to, like, learn how to react to those people and support them as a friend. But I never really hear from people who are really close to those people who have struggled with mental health and how it affects them. And I am also aware that that's an experience that I have no idea about. And it's easy for me to read up really fast on how to react to people who've got mental health problems and how to help them and how to be very PC about it and not, like, you know, try and not say the wrong thing. But then I'm also aware there's probably lots of things that I could say to you that are offensive or things that would be intolerant or things that might, like, assume that I know your experience when I don't.
Yeah.
Would you say that's fair?
100%.
You've got me in one. End of podcast.
I think that with mental health issues, or I really struggle with the right terminology, because my go-to is I always want to say mental health problems, but obviously it's not always a problem. And mental health,
like, mental health status.
Yeah, well, everyone has mental health, right? So not there isn't people who have mental health problems and people who don't. Everybody has mental health, and sometimes it's good and sometimes it's bad. But with mental health, it's because we are social animals. We all of our lives we interact with everybody around us, and your disability, if you're really suffering, is going to affect your social relationships with everybody around you. So to think that a mental health illness only affects the person that is at the core of it is is not true, because obviously your relationships with your whole family and all of the things that you would usually be doing are affected. So if you're a mother, you can't care for your children in the same way that you would be able to if you didn't have a mental health illness. And if you're a child, you can't have the same relation. It just changes all of your relationships. Yeah. So yeah, 100%. And as a child of somebody who suffers badly with their mental health, I think that's the right way to say it. Should I just give you a rundown of my mum and my life?
Give it to me.
So,
it starts on a dark day in June.
A child was born.
It was a dark, dark night and the rain came down in torrents.
Do you know what? It kind of does start like that with my mum, because I'm 31 now and I've got...
Congrats. Thank you. What's it like on the other side of 30?
It's lovely.
Like, it's not as dark as you
thought. I feel like I've survived. I'm a survivor of the 20s. But yeah, so my parents were together when I was young, and I've got an older brother. They were all very happy. And then when I was born, my mother suffered really, really badly with postnatal depression. And that postnatal depression over the years has spiraled into lots of different things. And her diagnosis is insane. Like, she's had...
Literally, sorry.
No, but I shouldn't do that. That's me. That's me saying insane. I don't mean it like that. And I use the words crazy and mental, and I use them in all the wrong ways. Mm. And I don't mean to, but...
But we also know
I'm learning too. So she's had lots of diagnoses over the years. It's been manic depression, bipolar, schizophrenia, and at the moment it's manic affective disorder, which is, I think it's a new term for basically all the different types of mental health issues that she's been dealing with. So she has periods of mania, periods of schizophrenia, and also sometimes like deep depression. So it's a real mixed bag. And it's so she, over the years, probably since I've been born, she's been sectioned, I think it's 7 times. She's been in and out of hospital. For a lot of my childhood, she was in hospital and then she was home. So there's lots of adjusting depending on what her mood was.
Mm.
But yeah, a lot of my life has been defined by her mental health.
So there's never been a point in your life where she's not been dealing with that?
Well, it's difficult to say, because there are times of recovery and there are times of when she's feeling good. Mm. And I think I really try and shy away from saying she's well or she's unwell, because for her, that's never going to be the case. Whereas I think some people, like a lot of us, will deal with a period of depression or maybe anxiety and depression within our lives that might be connected to different stresses. You know, like if you're bereaved, or if you're going through a particularly hard time at work, or the breakdown of a relationship, is very common.
There's a timeline there to be like, yeah, and here people, are the points.
People really feel like they've been in it and then they've come out of it. Whereas for my mum, it's never quite been like that. I think, you know, before I was born, she had suffered with depression and some other difficult times in her life. But from that, postnatal depression, things really got much, much worse. And it kind of changed her life to how it is now. I'm not breathing in between my dad.
And then,
do you know what? I didn't know this was going to be so emotional to talk about. I'm like shaking.
Yeah. Oh, God. Okay.
I don't know if it's because you give me 4 cups of coffee.
Really caffeinated.
But yeah, I was just like, yeah, I'm really chill about my mom's mental health. I can talk about it anytime, anywhere.
I think... Because you started talking to me about it quite early on in our friendship.
But the moment we met.
It was this point of humour when you were like telling me funny stories, and they were all linked to having this. But I suppose, you know, do you always feel like you want to be the person to mention it first? Because you definitely did with me. You're always the person who's like, by the way, my mum's sectioned.
I've been shaped by this, so understand me for who I am. 100%. I've always been quite open about it. I think it's a... You know, when I grew up in quite a small town in Hampshire, and everybody knew, so it you know, she used to be a dinner lady at our school. And when she would come in and be a dinner lady, it would be after she came out of hospital. And then the next term, she wouldn't be there because she might be back in hospital. And she did a lot of work in our school. So she'd come in and do reading with the kids. And she'd work at the charity shop near the church. She used to go to big, you know, was a big part of the community.
Yeah.
So
she wasn't this invisible figure.
Everyone knew.
Mm.
And she's a real force of nature, my mum. Like, her personality, like, I really love her. And you know when people are like, I mean, this might be sound a bit weird, but you know when people are like, oh, she's so fiery. She's, you know, people kind of love this idea of these kind of wild women. Like, my mum is the sort of person that you can't ignore her if she walks in the room. Like, she is full of life. She's very beautiful, but I sort of watch her from afar because a lot of the time her mental health kind of prevents her from having a traditional mother-daughter relationship with me.
Right.
So I see all the reasons why people love her, and I get little snippets of it here and there. I mean, as she's getting older and her mental health isn't recovering in the same way that it used to when I was younger, I miss that a lot. But yeah, she's the sort of person that everyone knows.
Yeah.
When she's feeling particularly unwell, she'll cause a scene at the local bank. I remember walking to school. I used to walk to school with a girl down the road from me, and my mum had an argument with her dad in the bank about something financial, but she wasn't very well at the time. And she followed me to my friend's house, and her mum answered the door, and my mum was just like, "And this Mrs. Barclays." And I was like, "Oh God, she's on a rant." And she'd take the shopping trolley from the local supermarket and decide she wants to take it home because she's paid a pound for it, and would be walking around town. So everyone's that sort of that idea of like the crazy lady was my mum. And I don't want to use crazy in a derogatory way. I want to be really careful about that. But sometimes using language that people understand when they're not in tune
and signifies
with...
signifies. Yeah. Because we're talking about stereotypes. We're talking about, like, okay, the crazy lady around town. That's what people
obviously
call
that's
it.
Not her, but that, it is kind of what she's seen as.
Because I think in some ways, like... And, like, when you know... Maybe... I can't really remember how I felt when you told me, but I feel like my initial reactions would to be... To assume that... she was invisible in the community, or that she was just away somewhere, or like, you know, I don't know. There's this like this idea of the ill parent.
Like
elsewhere.
No one sees Charlie's mum because she's resting at home. Like,
we don't ask where Charlie's mum is.
No, but I think the type of mental health issues that she deals with are very visible and very big. I think when you're public. Dealing with periods of mania, you don't want to, it's not like some people who deal with very severe depression might disappear from public life sounds like it's a celebrity.
She's like a celebrity,
but she's very much in public life. Like she her relationship's completely changed, but she's always been very, very social. And so when you grow up with that, you know, everyone knows. So I always want to talk about it as much as I can, so people, the fact that the people might be talking about it behind our backs is more harmful than me talking about it to them.
Right.
And
so
I can,
like,
set things straight if I know.
Set the narrative first.
Yeah, so I think because of my childhood living in that small community, when I moved to London, I wanted to make sure it was still a part of my identity in a way. I don't know.
Could you think some people would react and say, oh, I just want to leave that all behind, or like, I just want to be Charlie now. I don't want to be Charlie, the mum with the person with the eccentric mum.
Yeah, like, I guess there's a part of that. Some... part of me, I mean, I have moved away from that town, and I think a lot of it is to try and figure out who I am, because when you have a mother that's so unwell, a lot of my teenage life, especially after my dad left, my brother wasn't kind of as active in her care as I was, so there was a lot of growing up I had to do, and there was a lot I didn't know about myself until I was able to remove myself from like day to day with her. So yeah, I had a lot to figure out. I was really really grown up in some ways, because you obviously, when you become somebody's next of kin and you're responsible for them, when you're over 18, you can sign, you have to sign for them to be sectioned. You have to be the person that's looking after their finances, be the person that's dealing with all of their paperwork and making sure they're safe when they come home and they're released into, I keep burping.
It's like emotional.
I think I'm
like...
feeling the honesty.
That's just like emotional gas.
I have had a lot of
history
coffee.
Gas when I talk about history.
You're dealing with a lot of kind of practical stuff. So I learned quite quickly how to, you know, look after bills and banking, and she needs to get to hospital, she needs to do this, she needs to do that, and it's, you're on autopilot with that. But then I remember being at university and I was watching something about, I was watching a film about a lesbian relationship, and I was like, am I a lesbian? And I was just literally, it came to, I was like, I have never ever thought about this because I didn't have that time to explore my sexuality or explore, I mean, that this, people who grew up with me would be like, shut up, you were having sex from 15. But
you're like, no, but like, intellectually explore my
sexuality.
But
like, just stop and think about what your life as an adult means to you. I then thought about that at university. I mean, I think I'm straight. I've married a man. I've had lots of relationships. Like, I've relationships with men, but I was quite excited. And I was like, oh my God, maybe I could explore that, make her think about that. And
I
thought about lots of new things when I was away from her, is what I'm trying to say.
Like, that was the making.
And can I say one thing as we are recording that I have to be really, really clear about, is the story of my mother's mental health is often told by me, because I am seen as somebody who might be more well than she is, even though I don't agree with those terms. But it's very much my idea of the story and my narrative, because I think in life there's no such thing as absolute, this 100% happened exactly like this, but I'm much more capable of telling the story of my childhood, which she has such a big part in, than she is. She could never sit down with you and really give you a very, very true account of her mental health. So I have to tell it, but it's very much biased by my own experiences and the sort of bubble I live in. And so it's quite a responsibility, and I have to be quite careful what I say, because from my perspective, she might be unwell, but from her perspective, she might be well. And I think it's quite important to understand.
Yeah, to like know that it's secondhand. But then it's also like part of your role isn't just like, you know, caring for her and being like kind of a daughter, but then also kind of a mum. And like,
It's
also
that, like, role reversal is probably one of the most challenging things. And
it's like trying to be her witness and take down her story.
Yeah.
While also like being part of it and like.
Yeah. And also, I don't know if a lot of people know this, but they still very frequently use electric shock treatment. So she's had it, I think she's had it about 3 times, where, I mean, if you've not seen it before, it's often, you often see it in like old films. It's like a very Victorian
Garden, right?
Thing. Yeah. Where you basically put some sort of a helmet on, and they send electric shocks through your brain. And when you're dealing with mental health, like kind of mania, and very personality disorder type of mental health problems, it can be really effective at resetting the kind of the balance in your brain. And often when we talk about my mother's mental health, we talk about the imbalance in her brain. And there's been a couple of times where it's worked extremely well, where she's had it and then she's come home and she's been very stable. And then, but the sort of downside of it is she has blank periods in her memory where she can't remember things and she can't remember what's happened. And I know she had a very, when I was about 21, there was a new type of medication brought out called clozapine, and it's very dangerous medication because it can really mess up your blood cells. So she has to have blood, she's been on it since then, so about 10 years now, but it can really mess up the balance of your blood cells. So we had to sign a thing to be like, she's going to take this to try and give her a normal life, rather than being kind of staying quite unstable and unwell for the rest of her life, and she can stay in her home. Anyway, so she takes that medication, and it's really, really helped, and she's had a long period of being quite stable. She has had a couple of breakdowns within the last 10 years, but all in all, she's been much more stable than she has in the past. But when there was a time where she was particularly well, and I was 21, and I think she was so shocked at how old I'd got, and there's so much she doesn't remember and so much that she feels like she's missed out on, and she'll try and be the mum to the 11-year-old, but
yeah.
I'm 21 now, and that is the most heartbreaking because, you know, there are things she doesn't remember. So the electric shock treatment is still happening, and I don't know, I'm really interested in it because it's something that the doctors will do. And it's like, hold on, I thought this was really brutal and really awful.
Yeah, but then if you're in seeing some ways, the effects that yeah. are good, you're like, oh, but...
And yeah. I've tried to talk to her about it, but she gets very upset because I think it's very confusing. Because I'm like, well, what did it feel like? What, you know, and...
Yeah.
She just can't remember. And there are things that she does when she is particularly manic. Like, for example, when I was 18, I was in college, she told people at my college that I was a prostitute and that I had AIDS. And she threw out all... No, but it's funny. Like, I think if we don't laugh at this, yeah. we're going to cry, right? At the time, I was just literally like, I don't even know how to react to this. But she threw out all of my clothes and I didn't have any clothes.
all of them.
Yeah, because she thought, I mean, it's she's obviously didn't understand what she was doing, but in her mind, she thought all the clothes had AIDS on them. I mean, obviously, that's not how you get AIDS. Let's be very clear. But I mean, she was very unwell at the time, and I was just like, asking people if I can borrow clothes.
You're like, why? And you're like, well, my mum threw them away because I have AIDS. Yeah, but I don't have AIDS.
And I just started. I started seeing a new boyfriend, and he was like, rang me and was like, he texted me and was like, oh, I think your mum's telling everyone you've got AIDS. I was like, okay. And it's like, you know, you have to go and explain to people what's happened.
Okay, so I'm thinking of like the X Factor style approach to tragedy, where it's like, you know, do you ever find that people are like, that must be so hard for you?
Yeah.
Please cry in front of me on cue.
Yeah.
And then also like the takeaway that they want that is, but you wouldn't have any other way, right? And like your life has been better and you've learnt loads.
Oh,
and like,
God,
you know,
yeah.
do you feel like people
hashtag no regret
those two sides of the narrative on you? Because that always like makes me really uncomfortable on X Factor when they're like, this person has been through this horrible thing.
But it's made
showcase
me strong.
It.
Yeah. Yeah. I think
are you gonna go on X Factor and sing Evergreen and everyone's gonna cry?
Well, when that element of it, when I did a TV show called Tribal Wives, when I did that TV show, they got people, real women in their everyday lives, going away to live with a tribe. Brilliant. Fucking fantastic. I want to go live with a tribe. I'd never really left the UK much apart from like a girls' holiday to Magaluf.
Yeah.
And I was really excited. But the thing about it was when they spoke to me, they obviously found out about my mum and my childhood. And I think that was the reason they put me through for the programme.
Yeah.
So the top of my television debut, I was really excited about, was me being like, my childhood was really difficult. This is what happened to me.
Yeah.
And it was that I was like, oh my God, that's how I'm being defined as the young woman that has a sick mum, and so much of my life has been defined by that. But she's my mum. Why would I not want to be defined by her? I love her.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
It's
hard. I think in terms of people's reactions to when you've got somebody who's been so sick, is there is that thing of, oh, poor you, your life shouldn't have had to have been like this, and look how well adjusted and fine you are now. And for so long, I took that sort of narrative and being like, yeah, it's great that I'm still here and still functioning, or whatever you see as being healthy or good or kind of virtuous. And I always took that compliment on and was like, yeah, this is who I am. But then you delude yourself into the fact that you are okay, because everybody wants you to be okay. And they make an assumption that you're okay before they've really checked.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
And yeah.
When I've
they don't leave room for you to not be okay.
Yeah. And it's just like, look at you, you're not fucked up. And it's like, we are all fucked up.
Yeah.
I am deeply fucked up. Like, I am...
Yeah.
My mental health isn't good.
Mm.
I mean, actually, no. My mental health is varied, is the truth.
Yeah.
Like, I've had depression. I've had anxiety. I've even, you know, I've had times where I've been... Had eating disorders and, like, self-harm.
Mm.
And because of the you know, comparing that to what my mum's been through, because my experiences haven't been completely life altering and haven't led me to hospital and haven't, you know, they've not been as serious and they've not been as life changing as my mother's, so I'm like, I'm fine. But it's like, you go to the doctor and you're like, I don't know what's wrong with me. I'm just like crying every day and I don't know why and I can't get up and I'm this. And they're like, you've got depression. And I'm like, no,
that's what
I've seen
has.
Depression. Yeah, yeah. And I've got my own prejudiced about mental health that I never thought I had because I had a mum that's got mental health problems. But for me, my role was always to protect her, to look after her. And so much of my focus in my life was to do with that, that when I moved away from home and went to university, I was so riddled with guilt. I mean, I nearly didn't go, but with mental health, the way you care for them isn't the same way you'd care for somebody with very physical issues. So there's not much I can do day to day for her. What I can do for her is make sure her finances are okay, make sure she has a safe, warm home to live in, and that she has a community of people around her that we can call upon if we need to. It's like when you have a child and you remove all the sharp corners and you make sure they don't go too close to the edge. And I feel like my duty and my role to her is to do that so she can live her life. What she doesn't need is her grown-up daughter being like, are you okay, do you need anything, can I make you dinner, can I do this for you, because she needs to be able to do those things for herself, and that's the whole point of her personal recovery. But when I was removed from her, when I left home and I moved to London, which is only an hour away, it's not like I was the other side of the world, and I always made sure I had a car that I can get back to her and I can be there for her when I need to. But I just fell into this depression, and it opened my eyes so much to what depression is, a small part of what it feels like, what it might have felt like for her. But I was so in denial that it was happening to me and that you could have that.
Because you'd had this really close proximity, like, demonstration. So you're like, it's okay, I've named that. That's what depression
is. And the fear of it, that I might get sick like she gets sick.
Yeah.
But why am I so afraid of that? Because, I mean, I am, because her life, there are points where she's had a very, very tough life. And I'm scared for that. And I'm scared for the people around me that they might have to look after me the way that we look after her. I am afraid of that. But... yeah, but it's all of my own prejudice coming out. Mm. And I was like, I always think I'm this really, like, right-on person. And then when it happens to me, I'm like, can't be happening to me.
You're like, I'm invincible.
Surely, yeah.
It's like, it's always important to recognise your weaknesses and flaws, apart from when it's me, and then I am the strongest person ever.
Yeah, and then I started analysing my own mental health and the way I cope with things. And, you know, I've always had something that I do to cope. Like, when I was a kid, I used to pull out my hair. Mm. I had a really thick parting at points. And then people started noticing it, so I started pulling out the hair in the back.
Mm.
And then when I was a teenager, I used to make myself sick.
Mm.
And I wouldn't go as far to say that I had a real, real problem with bulimia, because I think that's disrespectful to people that have very, very serious eating disorders. But I do something that harms myself. And I am even still now trying to struggle to get out of that routine. And I replace it with different things because it's like my little coping strategies. And I'm 31 now. I got married last year and I've got a long-time relationship with somebody who is very close to me and in my life and is now my closest relationship. Because he's been my closest relationship for a long time because we've been together a long time. But for most of my life, it was my mum. She was my person that we're close to. But because my role was more dominant in caring for her, I got away with pulling my hair out. I got away with making myself sick. Mm. I got away with, overworking. Like, I'm a bit of a workaholic and I'll push myself to crazy points to make myself unwell. But then when you've got somebody in your life that's close to you, he's like, what are you doing? Mm. You're hurting yourself. Why'd you do that to yourself?
You're here now
and it's
noticing.
Like, stop being a witness to me. Let me just get on with this. And I remember being a kid, I used to sit in the car and just hold my breath for as long as I could. And then be like, and my dad was like, what are you doing? And it's like, nothing, I'm fine. And then I had a thing where I couldn't walk up the stairs and I would count at the bottom of the stairs and like little kind of twitches and little things that affect my mental health that I need to address to calm myself down. And anyway, I have lots of weird things that happen when people go, you're so fine and well adjusted. And it's like, well, no, because I can't walk upstairs without counting them. And
there's lots of peripheral things that might not be like So before we turn the mic on, we were talking about like different ways.
We said we would never speak about what we spoke about before the mic had turned on.
It's going to the press. Put it in. About this idea of like passing privilege, or like the fact that I could maybe meet you in a professional setting, and I wouldn't guess that you'd lived in a house without heating. Or I might, I don't know. There's a way of like me taking social cues from the way you are and assuming the life that you've led.
Yeah.
You know? And is that, like, how have you ever, like, how have you experienced that with people? And, like, do you... Does it frustrate you? Or, like...
I think there's often a frustration that people think you've had an easy life or a very privileged life. Because, you know, I'm from Hampshire. I sound posh. I'm white. I grew up with people who are very wealthy. I went to state school, but a lot of, you know, work in the media, people who are, a lot of people I work with went to private schools. And I think anybody who's dealing with a parent who has severe mental health problems will have to deal with financial issues and the benefit system. And living in an environment that's much more volatile, much more to the edge, much more to, like, on the breadline, for want of a better word. And I think that's a really important part of who my family is and who I am. Because I think when you've experienced the benefit system, when you've experienced, like, the heating thing, like, when my mum was in hospital before I was 18... I couldn't take control of her bank accounts. I mean, not that I don't take control of them now. We work on them together, but I'm allowed to ring the bank and talk to them about her direct debits and set things up.
That would never occur to me until you started telling me about it. And I was like, oh yeah, who does look after somebody's bank account when they're in hospital? What?
Yeah, and often when people have mental health problems, it can manifest itself. I mean, I say often, that's not right. I'm constantly correcting myself, and I don't want to be offensive to anyone's experience, but my mum's experience with mania means that sometimes she loses control of her finances, and sometimes she will overspend. Like, I remember being a child and being, we took the coach to London and just spent fuck loads of money. Like, we just got loads of toys. We bought matching tracksuits and would go to the shop and spend money, and then my dad would be like, we have to take all of this back. Like, And anyway, so when she's unwell, when I was under 18, I didn't understand, and my dad had left, so I didn't have an adult around to ask the questions to. And then you start getting bills through the door that are red because you haven't paid, and the heating's off, the radiators are broken, what do you do? I remember I taped two hair dryers to the corners of my bedposts and put them on for 20 minutes before I went to bed, so I could be warm in bed and had hot water bottles in bed because it was cold. You know, somebody smashed our front door, couldn't fix it, so I put plastic bags over the top of the front door, but I was scared people were going to come in the house. And like, just not having the money that people might have had when their parents were earning money, I think. Like, I you know, my friends, I'm not saying where I'm from was like Beverly Hills, but some people were well off, some people weren't as well off. So I didn't, it's not like all my friends were really mega rich and I wasn't. They were, you know, normal working families. But like, having dinner coupons at school and getting school trips for free because we didn't, you know, didn't have the money to pay for things. And I remember being off school, and my friend, who I actually fell out with over this, and I feel really guilty because she didn't know, we didn't know, you know, we were young and naive, but... someone was like, where's Charlie? Is she okay? Is her mum gone into hospital? Because people sort of knew. And if I wasn't around, they knew that maybe that's why. My friend was in our RS class, and the teacher was like, is she okay? And she's like, she's fine. Her dad gives her money for food. And it was like, my dad gave me £40 a week.
Yeah.
I was living with my mum on my own. I had no other money. I had a part-time job and stuff. But I was really... I just turning 16, and I was trying to save up for a car so I could run a car so I could look after her. So for me, that wasn't much money, and I'd do my shopping and I'd spend £20 on food and things I needed for the house, and then the rest of the money would go on petrol so I could visit mum. And I used to do athletics as well, so I used to pay my subs. And like, it's just getting by and the assumption that if you're claiming a benefit, you must be doing really, really well and you're fine.
Because that's the rhetoric.
Like, my dad gave me £40 a week to buy clothes and to pay for things. So, you know, mobile phone bills and
buses. And,
but when you're looking after somebody, you have to make sure you're in a position to always have petrol in your car. Because if she needs to get somewhere, you need to find her, you can get to her. Or if you need to buy something for her. Because when before she went into hospital, a lot of the time she would go off walking, or we'd lose her and we can't find her and we're searching for her. As soon as I could drive, I wanted to drive so I could find her and take her to hospital and visit her. And it helps. It really helps with caring for somebody when you're mobile. And then when she's in hospital, she needs things. She needs clothes. She needs treats. You want to be able to turn up with a bunch of flowers. Or do you know what I mean?
You might be the only person she's seeing. So it's like you have to,
So I got myself in quite a lot of financial... not trouble. I've never been in real trouble financially, but definitely taken out ill-advised credit cards and overdrafts to try and maintain a certain life. And then when your friends are going on holiday, you dig into savings or things that you've had.
Mm.
Like my nana died, she left us a bit of money. So I used that money to go on to Nuki with my friends and to do all this stuff. And then everyone's like, well, you've got this money, what's wrong with you? And it's like, I don't get anything from mum, because she doesn't have anything herself. I don't know.
It's hard when you see people doing things and so Amanda Palmer has this thing about taking the donor. So instead of, because she funds her life through Patreon and she always feels really bad for saying that she's having a cocktail, because it's not who's part paid for of that the cocktail. Basic, it's this idea of Maslow's hierarchy of needs, where it's you have if you're struggling for money, then you should only eat porridge, and if you're having a donut, what are you doing? And there's that kind of
the Prosecco thing, when people go, "Oh, Prosecco," and it's like, you do know it's £5 a bottle.
It's like the different kinds of Prosecco.
I think it's quite important. And this is a privileged position to say this, it's important to try and live your life as fully as possible, and participate and have a drink out every so often, and have, go to the pub. And I think there is a lot of shame attached to claiming benefits. And for my mum, she lives, at the moment she's not in hospital, and she lives a very quiet life, because she feels a lot of guilt for claiming benefits for so long and having disability living allowance. And to go out for dinner, she'll go out for dinner, once every 6 months, or
because there's shame attached.
I see something in the dark, something you won't find on Noah's Ark.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Life is full of what ifs. Some awesome. Like, what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome. Like, what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
But they're searching for a soul that isn't mine. Come now and take it from me. Search my broken body, then leave it as you found. Come now, replace
don't take to chaos. The worst was like, you.
Tell me.
No, I'm joking.
You know, like, you want to see those extremes and be like, how, you know, how can we help? Because I feel like, for me, like, I grew up with some friends who definitely, I had a very, like, happy childhood. And my parents were, like, disgustingly in love. Like, just, it's so gross. But, like I learned a lot about their experiences, not only from listening to them, but more from stuff like Jacqueline Wilson. So, like, The Suitcase Kid is about divorce. And I was because all of my friends' parents were divorced, like, in comedy. Yeah. I was just like, nobody was together, and my parents were together, and I thought it was weird. Or, like, The Illustrated Mum, did you ever read?
I haven't read it, and I need to read it, because a lot of people, as an adult, have said, did you ever read these? You would have loved these when you were a kid. And I was like, nobody told me about this. Yeah, nobody told me about this. So I didn't have access to things like that. The best support and the best reactions were always my friends who were my age and who were like, oh, that's shit, mate. Let's carry on. Like, and like, just people who were normal about it. The worst reactions were probably the really well-meaning adults, and this isn't all of them, because there are some wonderful, like, some of my friends' parents are really amazing, and they fed me a lot. They you know, they let me sleep over when my mum was really ill and I couldn't go home, and give me lifts and check in on me. But, you know, especially in school, they were like, oh, should we talk about it? Do you want to talk about it? How are you feeling? It's, you know, it must be really sad. And for me, it's your life, so you're not always ready to sit down and talk about how sad it is. You need somebody to be like, okay, so you need to pay council tax, you need to pay gas, you need to pay electricity. Like, practical advice I really missed out on. My friends were amazing because they didn't let it define me, and they were always very chilled out about it. Yeah, exactly. They're like, we're going on holiday, are you coming? How can we make this happen? And when I went to university, my boyfriend at the time's mum just sat me down and was just like, why on earth would you not go? Like, you've been accepted, you've got the grades, you have to go, you're going, and basically posted the letter for me. But I had a thing where you have to get your parents' signature to say you're going. And my mum wouldn't sign it, and she called 999 because I asked her to sign it. 999's banned on our house phone because she used to ring it a lot.
I was like, can they block it?
Yeah.
Oh, no.
Because she kept ringing. She kept ringing it. So, for me, just practical advice, because emotionally, when you're ready, that's really good. But people offer you emotion, but actually people don't offer you emotional support in a tangible way. They go, if you ever need to talk, you know where I am. That is really difficult to take that up. But if someone says, do you know how to use your lawnmower? I can show you and help you maintain the house while your mum's away, or even while she's there if she can't do it. Or I can come round and help you do some cleaning. Like, I didn't know you needed to dust until I was about 21. Like, I lived in
dusting thing. I still think it's a myth.
But, like, it's just
the
practical lessons that maybe other people learn from their parents that I didn't get to learn because mum wasn't able to teach me is what I missed.
I think that the kind of talking cure idea is interesting, because I think a lot of people, I mean, it's much more common now for people to want to go and go for therapy and talk to professionals.
Yeah.
And it is like a professional thing in some ways.
Yeah.
But like, I feel like when it's like, if you ever need to talk, there's like literally no emotional labour for the person listening, apart from showing that they're listening. Do you know what I mean? Like, they can just be like, talk at me about your issues. Whereas, and I think that's like a weird default to go to.
Yeah. And I think when you're not the person who's suffering as, you know, when you're a relative of somebody who's in hospital for their mental health, all the focus is on them. And it's like, are you okay? Come find me if you need anything. But the effect it has on you, as, you know, to love anybody who's suffering that badly and to love anybody who is so stigmatized by society and trying to fight for them, it's grueling and it is tough, however much I will do it. And, you know, I'll always be there for her. I'll always do it, but it's tough and it's hard. But I don't know, it's difficult because the whole of your life is focused towards this person who is really struggling. And with all your might, you want to look after them. But there are points where you have to look after yourself. And it's really difficult to do that with a society that's much more set up for, in more recent times, mindfulness, talking therapies and understanding your own emotions and feelings, but sometimes all you really need is she needs a lift to get a prescription. Can you help me do that? Yeah. Can you help me normalize the situation? Yeah. And I mean, I don't want to put anything down because some people find talking therapy very good. I find it very emotional and very difficult. And maybe I've only had one session of it.
Yeah.
And often the focus is, but do you think you're feeling unwell? And it's like, I'm not here because I'm unwell. Maybe like, I am a little bit unwell.
I'll tell you when I realise it. Yeah. Leave me alone.
And it's really difficult to say what the right and wrong thing is. And I really struggle, I think I've told you before, with the online campaigns of things you shouldn't say to somebody with depression. This is how you deal with this. And I understand that creating a society where we're much more open about our mental health is so, so important. And I'd never say that's not a good thing to do. But for somebody who has got it wrong at times, who's maybe said the wrong thing, to feel that weight of responsibility on you for their mental health is really hard and really damaging. If you have a friend and you're pussyfooting around them, that might not be helping them, but you as well cannot be responsible for their mental health. If you behave the wrong way around somebody who's suffering with their mental health, that doesn't mean that you are the reason that they feel suicidal, that you're the reason they feel depressed. And the campaign we need to really get behind is to get more funding for the NHS. That is the way we do this is to have our systems of authority say this is very, very, very important and we are going to make this better so we can normalise it. So when people go into hospital, they don't freak out because all they see is horrible depictions of mental health in films. Like growing up with One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest...
Jane Eyre with the crazy wife in the attic.
Exactly. And then now we're moving towards a much more accepting society, but there's no fucking money. Yeah. So we can all be like, I understand you, we're all okay. Oh, go to hospital. You might have to sleep on the floor because there isn't any beds, but we're still going to section you anyway. Oh, we're going to put you in a prison cell because you seem like a damaged yourself. It's like, it's so damaging.
Yeah.
And even like Prince William and Harry and Kate sitting down talking about their mental health, I'm like, it's really nice to see. And I don't want to put it down.
Yeah, you don't want to be like, I don't want that to happen.
We need your help elsewhere as well. We need money.
I mean, while it's like a good contributor to the conversation, and there is a certain type of person that will react really well to Prince Harry talking about his mental health.
Yeah.
And unfortunately for them and their attitudes to life, they're the only kind of people that will actually make them listen.
Yeah.
Because they're so, like, I don't know, they're really, like, people who respect the monarchy in that way might have been like, mental health's a pile of bullshit. And then they see Prince Harry talking about it and they're like, well, the prince has spoken.
Yeah, yeah. And it's kind of like catch up to where we're at, mate, because we've been talking about this for a long time.
Yeah.
No, that's like, really, that is Harry? Rude. I don't mean it.
I mean, he's been struggling with his mum's death, whatever.
It's horrible, but
you know, I know what you mean. It can be used as a like diversion tactic to be like, look over here, don't look at the actual real life effects of pulling NHS funding from mental health, look over here, Prince Harry.
Well, I suppose it's the issue with charity giving rather than the government getting behind things. Mind Mental Health Charity are insanely good. They are amazing.
That should be their slogan. Insanely good.
Oh my god, I've done it again.
I love it though.
I don't feel like I use that as soon as we turn on the microphone. I keep saying this is awful.
But then how do you feel, again, that's another like one of my like stupid questions I want to ask is like, how do you feel about those words? Because I'm catching myself really recently saying them a lot. But I was like, but what are the other words? And you know, when we police all of our language in that way, does it stop being effective? Like,
I think about it with the, a lot of people might disagree with me and I can't speak for anybody else but myself. But my mum uses the word crazy a lot.
Yeah.
And she'd be like, when I was crazy, or I'm feeling a bit crazy today. And it's language we use within ourselves. And it's like using, with body positive movements to being like, no, you can call me fat. Because
fat isn't bad. Exactly.
For me, I feel like the assumption that somebody, calling somebody crazy and calling somebody insane is bad, because you're putting that on somebody's personality and you're making an assumption about their mental health. But to call the situation crazy, for me, isn't as bad in that. Maybe that's why I use it, but maybe I'm wrong. I'm still very much learning and trying to understand the way we need to talk about things versus my experience. Because when I was younger, you know, in the 90s and early noughties, there wasn't a dialogue about mental health. So we made up our own rules in my house. And people often would never challenge me on the way I speak about things, because my mum's had this experience, my family's had this experience. So then you come into the wider world, especially the world of social media and more largely the intellectual world, where they're saying, you're saying the wrong thing. And I'm still learning what the right thing to say is. But my intention is of love and equality for everybody who's suffering, you know. But I'm getting it wrong and I'm still learning. And I think we will never stop learning how to talk about all of these things.
Again, I don't know if mine's like a controversial attitude, but I feel like while it's important to have conversations about language, it's not as important as actually doing things about it. And whatever, stopping people from, like, silencing people by telling them they're talking about it in the wrong way, stops maybe the people that really need to talk about from talking about it or feeling like they can, because there's this academic conversation happening. Because even in places like Tumblr, I feel like there's lots of young people now who might have been you like 10 years ago who aren't on Tumblr and aren't having these really progressive conversations and don't understand there's a third, you know, lots of genders, and you know they're not part of that conversation. And when you say you're saying the word crazy, you can't say that, you shut down those people. That it is a class thing as well, I think. I don't know, and an intellect thing,
definitely. But it's something I really struggle with, and it's something that I feel like I get wrong a lot, and I do have to struggle I do struggle to keep speaking, because I do feel quite silenced by when I get something wrong. I think, oh shit, I need to not talk about that. And I need to be stronger and be like, no, learn, understand, think about it within its context, and try and form new ways to have that conversation. And then, but then I feel the same about sexism and gender inequality. I've been brought up in a world that is inherently sexist. I'm unlearning so many things every day. And every time you're thinking and being conscious, you're trying to work towards something. And then suddenly you're like, for me, like I relax and say something and I'm like, fucking hell, why did I say that? It was so stupid. But yeah, I think it's a conversation we've got to have, but we have to be very, very careful to not underplay the funding for the NHS and underplay the fact that if you're really suffering with your mental health, the place that you need to go is to the doctor, and there is no shame in that. Rather than
professionals
feeling like, as a friend, if you say the wrong word or you say the wrong thing, that you're damaging somebody. Because with my mum, I grew up with somebody who was particularly volatile and changeable. And as a teenager who was particularly volatile and changeable, it could be quite a toxic environment to be in. And there's lots of arguments in our house. There was lots of... I grew up in a house where a slap around the face wasn't a problem. You were punished with a smacked bottom when you're a child. As you got older, violence was still used as a way to control us as children. So there, and for other people that's really shocking, but in my experience, like I mean for example, when I was 18, my dad had left and he'd started a new relationship, and my mum found out, but she was in feeling particularly unwell. And actually after this event she was sectioned about a week later, but we had an argument. There was very passionate, upsetting argument about me visiting my dad. She didn't want me to go. She didn't want me to leave to go and see them. It resulted in, you know, a slap around the face, bit of pushing, and she eventually locked me in the living room of our house, and I couldn't get out and I needed to leave. And we were screaming at each other from both sides of the door. It was horrible. And for me to get out, I kept trying to open the door and she kept slamming it back at me. And then to get out, I opened the door and I kicked her out of the way and walked out of the house. And I'm not saying I didn't she didn't land on the floor or anything. I didn't hurt her, but I used force to get out. And she rang the police. And then the police rang me. And they were like, I think you know why we're calling you. And I was like, oh, is it because my tax disc is out of date or something? I didn't know because... But for us, that physical side of an argument wasn't unusual. I'm not saying we used to beat the shit out of each other.
Yeah, but that's,
you know, if I spoke out of turn, she'd slap me around the face.
Mm.
And as I got older, if she was blocking my entrance, I'd try and push to get out of the way. It's the same way she'd push me. And, you know. Anyway, so I ended up getting caution from the police for assault. And I had to have my fingerprints taken, my DNA taken, had to have a mugshot, you know, and it was all very, very serious. And the police, they said to me, you know, you have admitted that you have used physical violence against her and you threatened her, because in the throngs of the argument, I don't know what I said. You it was like something like...
Because she did you say that she'd hit you as well?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, yeah.
So it was always... I don't want to be like, she always threw the first punch or anything like that. But it was never a situation where I would just hit her and she wouldn't have done anything. And that's not to say that she was to blame or I was to blame. It was just the way we behaved. And I got a caution for it. And the police were like, look, we understand the situation that you're in and how difficult, and we wouldn't want to do this to you at this age, and seeing the situation, you're not in a bar brawl. You haven't beat somebody up.
You're
but
not
you,
a danger to the public or your mum or anyone. But
they had to do it because I came in and they were, you know, they were like, we want to interview you. I was like, sure. You know, tape recording what happened. And then I was like, and as I opened the door, I kicked her or pushed her with my foot or whatever way I want to try and downplay this, because I understand that from my perspective I don't want to sound like an absolute animal, but so the environment that I grew up in is not PC, so I really struggle to be PC. I don't remember why I started this chat, but
I think it's important to be like, these things happen and they're not, it's part of your experience, and you're, when it's your experience, you're allowed to talk about it and label it how you like. Like, obviously everyone can, like, filter it through whatever prism they're using.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, like, I'm never going to be like, this is what Charlie's childhood was like. And
Charlie's
like,
really violent. But I do a thing. I mean, this is... I haven't really told many people this, but when I get very, very upset, when I have really kind of... bad arguments or when something really bad's happened, I punch myself. And that sounds really silly, but I punch myself out of frustration on my legs and on my head, and it's really bad, and I'm really, really trying to stop doing it. But I have grown up in quite I don't want to say violent household, because it's not as if I feel like I've been violently or like physically abused,
but there are
'90s, like, there were lots of households where the children got a smack bottom.
Yeah, definitely. And I then that got a smack bottom.
And that grows to larger things when you get older and when your family's under so much stress. So I'm violent towards myself when I have feelings of guilt and feelings of frustration and upset that I'm trying to deal with, because I go to quite a dark place sometimes. I don't really know why. But then I've spoken to some other people, and a few people who have had members of their family who are either dealing with alcoholism, drug addiction, or serious mental health problems, have had serious things. I actually spoke to someone last week who I had to ask for work if he'd had any convictions, and he was like, I punched my brother once because he's an alcoholic and he came at me, and
that's on his record now?
I wasn't in a position to confide in him what happened to me, but I really wanted to reach out to him and be like, that's happened to me, and I understand the shame you must feel about that. And, you know, it delayed my career. I wanted to be a teacher. I couldn't do that because I had a caution. Last year, I had to travel to the US for work, and in the US, cautions are spent within 5 years, so it's not on my record anymore here. But when the US does checks for your visas, they go all the way back. So if anything's ever happened. So I had to confront it again, and I had to go into the US embassy just terrified that I'd be found out that I've had a criminal history, or for assault. It just says assault. It doesn't say that the situation you were in and the stress you were under, or the relationship you had. And it doesn't say that they hit you too, or, you know.
Yeah.
But when, you know, with the, at the police station, they were like, look, do you want to press charges? And I was like, no.
Like, yeah.
But she did, because she wasn't very well. Or no, she didn't actually want to press charges. She wanted to tell them what had happened. And she was sectioned a week after and was in hospital for quite a long time that time. She was particularly unwell. I think my dad leaving was quite hard on her. But, I think that sort of stuff feels very shameful and very secret. But it probably happens to a lot more people.
Does it feel like when you're in these kind of like very civilized institutions that are like, we just need to do a check on you for everything. It's more like an imagination thing of like there's like a kind of red light that goes on. Like, boop, you're buzzed out because you got a thing on your record without having an imagination as to why or like
what your situation is. And I think a lot of people who maybe got in trouble when they were younger, and for very various different reasons, like you can't escape that. You always feel like that's a part of you. And when you have a parent or a family member who's got really severe mental health problems, you're expected to be perfect all of the time. Like, if you lose your shit with them because they're going on and on about something, or they're preventing you from doing something, the guilt that's attached to it is huge. And people are like, why did you shout at your mum? You know, she's not very well. Yeah, and it's like, yeah, she's been ill all my life. Yeah. And it does get to you. And you have to be able to have a normal relationship, because obviously violence and, too much aggression isn't normal. But to lose your temper with your mum and be like, mum, just leave me alone, is normal. But... Yeah. When with that element to it, people think you're really mean, and it's like, no, because I have to be able to have my feelings have to be valid as well. But that's still something I really struggle with. I've got a lot of guilt in me that I don't know where to put.
Yeah.
Because I was a teenager when mum was really, really sick.
Yeah.
So, you know, there were things that she'd do that I wouldn't understand, and I'd be like, mum, just shut up, you know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, like, when she tells everyone that you've got AIDS, I mean...
Yeah.
I imagine the argument wasn't...
Yeah.
...that ensued, wasn't there?
Yeah, exactly.
It wasn't going to be too, like, I see where you're coming from with the fact that you think I have AIDS. Like,
yeah, you're not going to come home and go, okay, you're going to be banging on the door being, mum, let me in. You can't chuck me out. And then you have to go to your friend's house. And but that behaviour, probably from a neighbour's perspective, they probably thought I was really mean. But and also I had it once where one of my mum's kind of care workers, so you have people that work with you in the community, so when you're not in hospital, they have somebody that comes to visit and you talk to. And she rang me up, and mum had asked me to leave again, and she just does that a lot when she's unwell. I mean, it's up and down. And she was just like, she rang me and was like, so... you and your mother have a particularly prickly relationship, don't you? And I was like, she's suffering with she's suffering with psychosis and parts of schizophrenia and a manic disorder.
Mm.
And you're going to come to me to say your relationship's prickly.
I'm going to chafe.
I'm her daughter. Like, that really hurts because... Yeah. Obviously, no mother and daughter have a completely happy relationship all the time.
Yeah.
But when you throw in the stress of personality changes, things are difficult. Mm-hmm. And I think people just assume that me and my mum are like best friends, and we're like more like sisters because she's been ill rather than her being a traditional mum.
It's not a sorority.
She's not always grateful for the help I give her. She often doesn't want me to get involved in things, and I have to try and get my way in a way that's not upsetting her balance. And it's always a case of trying to balance everything when, you know, it really affects your relationship. If you have to sign a piece of paper to say you're going to be detained under the Mental Health Act, that's basically sending your family member to hospital prison. You would never be like, yeah, I definitely...
That's so sisterly.
And
then we painted each other's nails and braided each other's hair.
Yeah, exactly. And some days she wouldn't want to see me. Some days she did want to see me. And it's fucking minefield.
I'm naive. And I think that when we first became friends and you were telling me about it, I couldn't believe that there wasn't more support for you. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I always thought, like, God, there should be, like, do you feel like you got enough support from, I don't know, I always feel that if you're under 18, probably social services get involved and they sort it out. That's not, is that a really stupid view to take? Like, is that?
Not really. I don't think anybody ever asked us if we were on our own at home.
Yeah.
Maybe there's a rule for if you're over 16, because I think when I was 16, it was me and mum at home, but she wasn't very well. So maybe that counts as having a parent at home. Mm. But the only people that really checked on us were people at the church. Oh. And mum gets really religious when she's feeling unwell. So we have got a connection with the local church, and we're always like, oh God, the church, boring. But then one Christmas they left a hamper outside full of...
And you were like, change my mind.
Yeah, literally, it was a whole Christmas dinner in a basket that they gave us. And like one year, me and my brother, we had... my mum came out of hospital for like 2 hours on Christmas Day, and we cut a sausage into three and had... we had bacon, baked beans... and like some potatoes, because me and my brother just didn't really have much in.
And
that sounds like we were like on the line. We were fine, but
it's more like
it's created. It's being able to afford all the things for events, but people don't really help you as the person who looks after your parent. Mum will receive the benefits when you know how to get them for her, but you don't really get much for you. And the care in the community people talk to you about her, but they don't really talk to you about you. And if they do, they're like, do you think you're feeling unwell? And it's like, there's a line of whether you're unwell or not unwell, whether you need help. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. You made me think a lot when you were talking about like mindfulness and talking about things. Because I feel like a lot of the time, maybe almost like social media and Facebook has become this talking therapy for us. Do you know what I mean? And this kind of like, that's how we all just talk about it on social media and then it's fine.
I find social media quite tough because you can never see somebody's facial expression, their tone of voice or their body language when they're saying something to you, because often the conversation around mental health, we challenge each other a lot. So it's quite easy to retreat into silence or retreat out of a conversation if you feel like you don't have the information, the same information that other people have got. Whereas if you're sitting down with somebody who has a lot of information about mental health and you can have a conversation with them and know that they're not judging you for not knowing, or it's much easier. And I mean, maybe I'm a bit too old for using social media to help me, because when I was, I got social media, Facebook started when I was at university. So I was quite far down our road by that point. So that was never somewhere I went for help. And also having somebody who has mental health problems in your home isolates you quite a lot from other people, and it's not something you want to always talk about. And sometimes when you're with your friends, even if it's just being online with your friends, you want to talk about anything but that, because it's defined so much else of your life. You'd rather just post a nice selfie up when actually in the other room something really bad's happening, or like, you know.
You're like, it's fine, I'll put a filter on it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like sometimes you just want to participate in the normal stuff.
Yeah, but I think it's kind of like just, I don't know, I'm trying to have more of an imagination of what's behind what somebody's doing online. Do you know what I mean? Just be like, I don't know.
That's the next step.
I could imagine. I'm not going to presume, but I am going to be like, there's more to all of these stories than we see.
There's much more to all of us than the thing we portray.
Yeah.
Portray online. I think the thing that we can do to help each other is by just giving each other practical help and talking amongst the practical help. Like, you know, if somebody you know has just had their parent go into hospital, give them a lift to the supermarket and help them do their shopping and chat to them, and then find out what they need
rather than the online work that needs to be done.
Rather than the come to me if you ever need anything. And I'm really guilty of saying that to people, but you don't often feel empowered to come to somebody to ask them for help when you need it.
So it's more like spotting and suggesting, being like, I'm gonna come and help you with your lawnmower, rather than
Do you know what though? I feel really underqualified, or I don't feel right giving advice to people because what works for me and what works for my mum doesn't work for everybody. Some people do, you know, some people do need people to talk to or want to take people up on that or go to talking therapy and do the things that maybe I've not done. So I don't think that, I think understanding that there isn't one way to deal with mental health is the path to equality. It's like, I think
like the answer is there is no answer.
Yeah, the answer is you have to understand that your mental health is just is varied and you could get sick too. So think about how we can make things nicer and less scary for everybody.
Almost like funding the NHS.
Yeah, almost putting a bit of money behind
it's like subliminal.
It.
Funny. Yeah.
Like mental health services. When I was really young, my dad had a job that gave him private health care. So my mum spent time in the Priory. Which is where we hear most of the stories about mental health from. When I read books about mental health. If I see something come up of someone's mental health experience, I'll read it to find out a bit more about them. And the spokespeople that we hear in the media who talk about mental health, like Ruby Wax, Frank Bruno, or just people who are a bit, you know, have a bit more money, who are privileged enough to be able to afford to go to places like the Priory or private healthcare, mental health. But having been a child visiting her there, then, you know, at a point, private healthcare with a company runs out and then you have to go to the NHS hospital, and seeing the stark difference between the way you're treated in private healthcare and NHS healthcare is insane. I've never... It's not a case of first-class economy seats on a plane. This is a completely different way to be. It's from being in a place that has lovely cushions and feels... I'm not saying it is... I don't know. I don't want to degrade people's experience by saying you had an easy ride, because they don't, because their mental health is still bad and it's still valid and it's still an experience that is theirs. But it feels, and NHS mental health top security places are like prisons.
Yeah.
You know, and it's uncomfortable. It smells. It's, there's not enough showers. There's not enough care, you know, for the people that are in there. Whereas in other places that people pay for care, are much, much, much more comfortable.
Yeah. So you think sometimes these figureheads of, like, mental health are, like, cool, but maybe, we like, Ruby Wax, we've heard enough from you.
Yeah, you know. So, and also in the media, they're like, oh, Susan Boyle's gone for a rest. And it's like, sure, I know you might not want to put a label on your mental health condition, but we can't see these places as places people go for a rest, because they're not the places people go to get better when they feel like they have a mental health illness rather than, you know. Yeah. Seeing the difference between NHS and private is huge. And when I try and bring it up, people are like, oh no, don't you think we just need to focus on mental health? And it's like, well, this is a really huge part of mental health, like the class structure within it, the way that if you're from a poorer family or more working class, your social status isn't as high, your ability to talk about it is very different. If you have a very severe addiction to alcohol and you have no money, your life experience is a million miles away from somebody who has a lot of money and can put you into a rehab facility. And I think we need to understand that mental health isn't just depression or self-harm. It's alcoholism, it's eating disorders. There's so many elements and aspects to it that we all face. We're very comfortable with a celebrity having a drug addiction. We're very comfortable with somebody going to rehab for something. But what they're doing is they're going to seek care for their mental health in the same way that my mother does when she... My mother. I don't know why I'm going so posh. When... I feel like I'm addressing the nation. When she gets sectioned, that's the same thing. If a celebrity can, you know... For example, if Russell Brand can come out the other side of his drug addiction and be present in everyday life, and we all love and respect him, we can do the same for my mum. But I don't feel like she's afforded that same privilege by people, because she, for her, that she'll always be someone who's sick and somebody who's
benefit.
We need to worry about. And actually, there are times when she's okay.
Just a person.
I feel like I've stopped breathing again. I feel like going on a little rant. I was like, is there something I want to say, and am I going to say it in the right way?
I have to finish up, because I'll probably do like an outro anyway. But I don't know. Is there anything else you want to, you know?
I don't know. We covered a lot of bases. Yeah. I think that the wild side of having a parent who's struggling with their mental health in whichever form is something that you can only really understand if you've been through it. If you have stories of police visits in the middle of the night, of, you know, of crazy shopping trips to Harrods with your mum as a child, where you spend any money your family thought they had. And it's really, it is, sometimes it can be hilariously funny.
Yeah.
And we have to recognise it for how kind of weird and wonderful
and
it is.
And it's allowed to be funny and also, like, concern, like, a concern for that people should have and, like, try to change it. But it's also...
And one thing that I always struggled with was feeling like I'm either doing okay or I'm just a fucked up kid because of my mum. And it's like, you can have your own issues whilst not being totally fucked up. And you can be doing well whilst not pretending that everything is 100% okay. Because I always feel like if I talk about my own personal mental health, everyone goes, oh, well, you know why. Or it's hereditary, or she's had a really tough time. It's like, I'm just like everybody else. My experience is slightly different to yours. Yes, when I come to your house, I will want to sit with your mum and get cuddles from her because my mum didn't really do that with me. I will want that. And I will crave that for the rest of my days because all I want is a mum that looked after me.
Yeah.
But I'm fine. Yeah. And everyone's experience, not many people actually have that mum or that parent that will do that for them. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. Let me rant at you. I feel like you've said about two words and I've said everything else.
I always feel like comfortable talking to you about it because I feel like you won't let me ask questions and I never make me feel stupid.
Search my broken body. Believe it as you found. Come now, but please tread lightly. I don't take to chaos kindly and go without a sound. Go without a sound.
Thank you for listening to this episode of I'm Not Being Funny But, hosted by me, Lena Norms. You can follow me at LENANORMS on Twitter. Also, a link in the description where you can join the mailing list so you never miss an episode. Please do review us on iTunes if you can. The music today was provided by Ashlyn Evans. I absolutely bloody love her music. I'm a Patreon. She's just released a new EP. You've got to go and listen to it. Thank you to Charlie for sharing her experiences. She has an amazing podcast with her friend Ruby called DAS, D-A-S. I'll leave the link to it below. It's amazing. And you can follow Charlie at CharlieBray. Thank you also to my friends in the Gumption Club. The Gumption Club is a Patreon-based creative community that I run. You get a free poetry collection from me for signing up. I'll leave the links to that below. Quite frankly, I'm going to go because I'm getting a dead leg. I'm recording this, as always, in a cupboard under some stairs. Call me the girl who podcasted. Okay. Log off and bug off.
Search my broken body, then leave it as you found. Come now, but please tread lightly. I don't take to chaos kindly. And go without a sound. Go without a sound.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello? Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.